Welcome to the Missing Chapter podcast, where you will hear some of the least known, obscure, and entertaining stories the history textbooks left out, starring Phil Horander and Phil Schauff.
Humans have worked for centuries to attempt to capture and use the sun's energy. With the decades-long usage of solar power technologies, have you ever wondered how harnessing this power was successful in the first place? Enter Maria Telkes, a Hungarian-born biophysicist, chemical engineer, and inventor who had a vision for the practical application of solar energy. Her near 50-year devotion to solar and its applications led to the creation of a variety of innovative and life-saving inventions, all while being undercut and thwarted by her boss and colleagues at MIT. Recognized as one of the world's foremost pioneers in solar energy, a tenacious scientist, and woman well ahead of her time, it's no wonder she was granted the appropriate nickname, the Sun Queen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, everyone. You are back with the Missing Chapter podcast here with Phil Horander and Phil Schauff. Phil, before we get to today's coffee, one of the things that we continually, in 3.5 seasons, have always gotten really good positive feedback on, consistently across the board, is when we have guest speakers on.
Yeah.
And we have guest speakers that really people look forward to hearing more from. Their episodes do extremely well. One of them happens to be here with us today.
And who is that?
It's Melissa Fisher, a science teacher here at Canjoharie. She's got another great story that we're going to be getting to over a cup of Utica Coffee Roasting Company's cinnamon bun.
I love this. Is one of my favorites.
It is.
You're probably, listeners are probably sick of me saying this. Like every coffee, it seems like, oh, this is one of my favorites, but it's top three.
Sweet icing, swirled with cinnamon and pastry, but it's a coffee.
And drizzle it with a little bit of like caramel macchiato creamer. Forget about it.
Yep. Oof,
it's really good.
And mix it up with a good story, which is what you're about to get here today.
Hey.
Couldn't be any better.
And I have to tell you, one of my favorite episodes, we've gotten this before too online, is that the one about the Radium Girls. Mm. Oh my gosh. We still actually talk about this. Every once in a while, we'll throw up some information on Chernobyl, some of the nuclear proliferation we've talked about with our classes. Mm-hmm. And we actually mentioned the story that you did about even using the down to the lipstick and having teeth fall out from this radio. It's so.
And Phil, you're going to remember this. We actually had a student come up to us and ask us if we were familiar with that story. And I said, completely on their own. We said, well, wait a minute. Mrs. Fisher did a podcast episode for The Missing Chapter with that. And they didn't know that.
Yep.
So it's just funny how those good stories in your field of science, they work so well into The Missing Chapter podcast formula here.
It sure does.
Yeah, that's great.
So based on your intro, we're really excited to hear this because, you left us with a little cliffhanger here. So
Definitely.
I'm curious. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I appreciate both of you having me back on. It's been a while, but, it was one of the things that, we have the same students and they've just been saying about how fast this year has been going.
Yeah,
and
that is true.
It just doesn't seem like it's been so long since I've recorded again with you. But
that's true, yeah.
So we're going to talk today about Maria Telkes. She was born in Budapest, Hungary, on December 12th, 1900. While in high school, she became interested in solar energy and went on to study physical chemistry at the University of Budapest, earning her bachelor's degree in 1920, and later her PhD from the University of Geneva in 1924. For a short time, she was an instructor at Geneva until she visited a relative who was the Hungarian consul in Cleveland, Ohio. In 1925, she decided to immigrate to the United States and accepted a position at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation as a biophysicist, researching energy production in living organisms, and eventually developing a photoelectric device to record brain waves.
Wow. How do you even get there? That's my, as a social studies teacher, I'm like, how do you go from, being a 20-year-old, getting your bachelor's degree in 1920, then I mean, that is a, that for is, me, I don't know.
That's
maybe
remarkable.
That's a big leap.
It is.
Right? To be that young and get that kind mm-hmm. of education, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, and from my research, she was one of the first women to be hired in the Cleveland Clinic Foundation.
Wow.
As an engineer. Yep. So in 1937, she eventually became a U.S. citizen and joined a team of research engineers at Westinghouse Electric Corporation, where she developed instruments that converted heat energy into electrical energy. It wasn't until 1939 that she'd begin her long career into solar energy research at MIT.
Wow. It's quite the resume already.
I mean,
it is.
And we're 2 minutes into the the discussion today.
That's interesting. I guess I never really thought about that. So we're looking at 1937 becoming a U.S. citizen. She's working at Westinghouse. And she started with how to convert heat energy to electrical?
Right, yeah.
Which essentially is what a solar panel produces,
yep,
correct?
So
this is pretty...
Well ahead of her time, that's
in
for sure.
In 1937, yeah. I guess I never realized how early that is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't either. That's amazing. So at MIT, she would become part of a project called the Solar Energy Conversion Project that worked with thermoelectric devices powered by sunlight. So her role in solar energy was pretty crucial during World War II, when she was assigned to the U.S. Office of Scientific Research. There, Telkisch developed one of her more important inventions, a life-saving solar distiller that converted seawater into drinkable water.
Wow. What? So like a desalinization kind of process?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yep. So this was incorporated into the emergency med kits of the U.S. military. So downed airmen and stranded sailors would be able to use this device to extract the salt from seawater, where it would condense into potable drinking water.
Is that a pretty involved process? I'm not familiar
yeah,
with that. Is
it's
it?
It's very involved, yeah.
Because I heard something on, it was actually on Joe Rogan when he had Neil deGrasse Tyson on, and he said, why aren't we just taking, we're 75% water on this planet,
mm-hmm.
why aren't we just taking the salt water and just converting it down? And he said, it really comes down to expense.
Yep.
It's much cheaper just to import plastic bottles of water than it is to desalinate salt water.
I know, you wouldn't think that it would be like that, but
right.
Yeah,
that
definitely.
That is true, though.
It is true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very reminiscent already of the fact that we did an episode one time on electric cars being around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was
much
a good one.
Earlier than you anticipated. And just hearing what you've had to say already, it's like all of this technology is so relative to 2024, and it's been around. Like, she was a mm-hmm. true pioneer in not only being able to develop the technology, but in realizing the importance of it, too.
Yep,
and
exactly.
The need for these things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely. So a little bit about the kits. So they were actually inflatable, made of a thermally insulated plastic film with closable inlet tubes at either end. Hmm. One of them was for water collection and the other for inflation. So when it was filled with seawater, the sun shining through would increase the water to vaporization temperatures, which would leave the salt behind.
That is brilliant.
Mm-hmm. It is brilliant.
Oh my God.
That is.
You ever been in a pool and you're in the inflatable and you know, the sun is beating down on you, and then you forget you're in the water, right?
Yep.
And the area that's touching the water that's touching the inflatable is nice and cool.
Yep.
And then you move just a little bit and you put your arm
in.
Oh my God, it'll burn your skin.
Yep. So after the water condensed back, it would then be safe to drink. So each of these devices could create up to a quart of drinking water per day. Later, this invention was actually redesigned to meet the water needs of the Virgin Islands and is still in use to this day.
What?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But initially, did she set out to do this technology for the military? You talked about the how they were using it. That was her original goal?
Yep, her original
okay.
goal, yep. So they specifically hired her to do this.
Okay.
Yep. So fast forward after the war, Telkisch was hired as an associate research professor in metallurgy at MIT. Becoming interested in heat storage, she worked with phase change materials that absorb or release heat when transitioning from solid to liquid form. In 1948, she partnered with architect Eleanor Raymond and sponsor Amelia Peabody to design the heating system of the Dover Sun House in Dover, Massachusetts. This was the world's first solar-heated residence.
In 1948.
1948.
I had no idea.
Am I the only one?
I mean, I guess that's the whole premise behind our podcast, but like, I have no idea like that this stuff existed.
1948.
I'm really naive to this stuff, that this was the technology even capable of.
Wow.
Much less actually being implemented.
Right.
That's amazing.
So Telkish's cousin, Dr. Anthony Nemethy, along with his wife and child, would actually live in the house. So this was kind of an experimental house that they were testing out to see how solar energy would be able to heat this this house. The house was kind of wedge-shaped, and it consisted of a row of 18 windows along the south-facing wall of the second story. Directly behind these windows, Telkish had built metal and glass panels that would collect the heat from the sun. The warmed air was then fan-forced through ducts into separate heat bins, one in each of the rooms in the floor below.
All right, so someone's going to make $1 million off of me right now. Mm-hmm. It's not my idea. It's my dad's idea. We've mentioned this in our
Yeah, you've
our
mentioned classes. It before. Here it comes.
For my dad's an avid listener. My mom's an avid listener. So they're probably going to be like, don't tell anybody. My dad has this idea. He's like, listen, we're living in upstate New York where it's frigid cold for 6 months. Then it's unbelievably sweltering hot for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we just bottle it in the wintertime, bottle the cold, and then release the cold, right, in the summertime?
Right.
It sounds so simplistic, but it's so brilliant.
It is.
And it's essentially what they were doing in this house.
Essentially, yep, exactly.
Wow. I mean, how efficient is that? It's got to be incredibly efficient, right?
Yeah, definitely.
You're using the natural heat.
Yep, using just the heat from the sun. Yep. So the within the heat bins, they were filled with one of the materials she was working with at MIT. It's called sodium sulfate, or Glauber's salt.
Okay.
So this was going to be the main heat storage material for the house. Now, sodium sulfate stores heat really, really well. It's about 7 times as efficient as water.
Hmm.
So on sunny days, the salt would melt, absorbing the heat and cooling the house during warm weather. During cold weather, the salt would then cool down and recrystallize, which would release the heat back into the house, which would keep the house warm.
There's my answer. So, Dad, if you're listening, we just gave you the formula for how to create your idea.
Yep. So, in theory, it was definitely a brilliant idea, but in practice, things didn't really go as planned. So, as we know, for us living in upstate New York, we know what salt does to our vehicles. So, the sodium sulfate ended up corroding the bins that it was stored in, causing them to leak. And with the constant melting and recrystallizing, the salt would begin forming stratified layers of liquid and then solid, liquid, solid, which prevented the substance from mixing properly. So after about 2.5 winters, the heating system failed completely. In 1954, it was replaced with a more conventional system using oil after that. So the house was exhibited at an MIT symposium in 1950, and was demolished actually not too long ago in 2010. Telkish was quoted as saying, "The problem of the sun-heated house cannot be solved by one or two experimental houses, but each new house is an experimental stepping stone toward the use of the sun as a fuel resource."
All right, you're back with the Missing Chapter podcast. Phil Horner, Phil Schoff, joined today by our good friend, Melissa Fisher. Now, Melissa, you kind of alluded to this. I think you mentioned it right before the break, in that salt, really, for us living in upstate New York, with regards to our cars in particular, is really destructive. And I think people, depending on where you are listening to us, and if you have ever experienced this, it does destroy the wear and tear, the life of your automobile. So it makes sense. I didn't kind of, you know, come to this conclusion on my own, but it makes sense hearing you say that salt in this area, this is what it's going to do. It's after 2.5 short years, it's really the downfall. So I guess the question is, if you came up with a different material, would that ultimately lead to more success for the system as a whole?
Yeah, if they could come up with maybe a new material that has as good, if not better, like heat storage properties than the sodium sulfate, and it's not as corrosive, then that would have been a much better solution, I think.
Just to compare, where my sister lives in Kentucky, the cars, like you said, they don't ever use... That's why they close if there's, like, flurries, right? But they don't use salt on their road. So if you look at the cars down there, there's cars 20, 30, 40 years old that look brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Even parts. Like my sister had an old Pathfinder that she never replaced the brakes and it had like 80 some odd thousand miles or even more because parts last so much longer. So I wonder if the longevity, it's got to be more efficient if once we can get over that hump there of trying to figure out the technology.
Right. If we continue on with the car, I mean, we use that for quite a few months here. So if you're heating your house,
true,
you know, with that, it's continual. That would be really bad.
Right, definitely. So a little bit later on, a couple of years later, 1952, Telkesh became actually the first recipient of the Society of Women Engineers Award for her accomplishments so far in her career. However, amidst this, not all was going well with her and her boss, Hoyt Hoddle, and other colleagues back at MIT. They originally had a lot of support for her with the solar project that she was working with. But with the failure of the Dover House, kind of turned to skepticism about the true usefulness of solar energy. So Telkesh was blamed for the problems with the sodium sulfate, and with receiving a less than favorable report on the lack of productivity of the solar project, it unfortunately resulted in her termination from MIT.
Wow.
So there were definitely some struggles that she did overcome. In the following year, 1953, she continued her work in solar energy research at the New York University College of Engineering, where she received a $45,000 grant from the Ford Foundation to develop a solar-powered oven that would cook food for people living in developing countries.
Wow. And again, the theme from that I took away from the first half of this is just so far ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just hearing you say this, developing things for not only consumer and practical use here in the States, but also to help developing in third world countries and people in impoverished areas.
Yes.
So far ahead of our times. So that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So just using the power of the sun, the sunlight can warm up the food. So mm-hmm. the oven was pretty simple. Essentially, it was an insulated metal box with doors on either end and covered with some glass above the area where food was placed. There were four metal plates with triangular mirrors that were positioned at 60 degree angles surrounding the glass. So if you think of maybe like a box with the flaps open,
mm-hmm.
at angled at 60 degrees, that's kind of how it looked. So the stove could reach temperatures of up to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and it only cost $4 to reproduce.
Whoa.
Oh my gosh.
So definitely not bad.
Wow. What year was that again?
This was in 53. Yep. So this stove found itself definitely a popular market in mid-century India, which fit the climate Telkesh envisioned for this project. So during a demonstration of this solar oven, she was quoted as saying, "Everything seems to taste so much better when it's cooked by the sun."
Oh, that's awesome. As you were describing that, I immediately thought of my elementary school science project where we had the group, you probably remember this too, because a lot of schools have done this, where you try to get as much heat inside the box as possible and try to fry an egg. I remember going outside and cooking this in the sun, and this egg would fry, this egg wouldn't. Why would, what kind of materials we're using? Is it too much black? Is the flaps at the different angles? I remember all of that. It's
mm-hmm.
amazing. So now to put it into kind of a grand scheme, then you're bringing it to an impoverished India, which at the time probably still had over a billion people,
right. mm-hmm.
With a lot of famine too. So that's an incredible way of using the technology in a way that helps other people. That's
definitely
great.
Yeah.
So I guess my question for you, I don't really know where you're headed with this with regards to my question, but I'm curious as to whether or not she actually benefited from this financially. Did it lead to future success for her?
I'm not sure about financially. I didn't
yeah.
really find any of that. But as far as success, like with awards that she was mm-hmm. granted, and she was going to be inducted in the Hall of Fame for engineers, definitely, as far as world renown.
Good.
Yep.
I wasn't sure where we were in history if she would get the recognition mm-hmm. that she was deserved. So that's
yep.
at least, comforting to
mm-hmm.
hear. Yeah.
Yep, definitely. So a bit later on, she worked for a few years in some industrial settings,
mm-hmm.
becoming the director of Solar Energy Lab at the Curtis Wright Company, which actually was founded in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. From 61 to 63, she worked at Cryotherm, developing materials withstanding extreme temperatures for the Apollo space mission.
Oh, nice.
And also Polaris underwater missiles.
That is insane.
So that was, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, the versatility of what she's doing is really benefiting a number of different areas.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely.
And to no surprise, really, our space program at this point. Again, you talk about the context of the time she's developing all of this. It would make sense that they would want to get their hands on mm-hmm. some of her advances as well.
Yep. And then a little bit later on, from around 1963 through 69, so for about 6 years, she worked as director of solar energy at Melpar Incorporated. So the oil crisis of the 70s, so here we're in the 70s, so she's her career spanning across many decades. So the 70s spurred an even further interest in solar energy. In 1977, she was recognized and honored with the Charles Greeley Abbott Award. And in 1980, she was called upon by the U.S. Department of Energy to assist with a second experimental solar heated house in Carlisle, Massachusetts, which was the first to use actual solar panels on the roof.
Wow. Unbelievable. 1980?
Yep, 1980.
80.
Yep.
Got it. Which, you think of solar panels, you think of a modern technology. I do definitely don't think 1980 having the first house with it.
Right.
And I, while you were talking, I looked up some of the materials inside a solar panel. You know, I don't see anything that could be considered corrosive. And I wonder if it's because of her work that try to figure out, hey, there's some elements in here that we really shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Because it won't last awfully that
long. Right. So they were able to take that data that they collected from the first Dover house. And over 30 years, they could refine it, redevelop it into the solar array that we
Amazing.
Use today. So over the course of her career, she, Maria Telkisch, she was nicknamed the Sun Queen by her colleagues. She earned some 20 patents, national recognition, and served as a consultant to a variety of companies and organizations around the world until her death just 10 days before her 95th birthday. On December 2nd, 1995, in Budapest.
You want to talk about her contributions. I mean, outside of all of her scientific contributions, really a pioneer for women's, you know, paving ways in areas that women weren't accustomed to being recognized in.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
Important to note as well, I would think.
So as we close, Melissa, in typical Missing Chapter fashion, like we always try to highlight some of these people that are unknown. And you look at her resume, 20 patents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, she is dubbed the Sun Queen for a reason, right? So when we look at, like, the modern technology, we think of the Elon Musks of the world who is putting solar panels on as shingles now, which I think is a brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm.
Solar panels as windows that you can see through. Why don't we know more about this Telkisch woman?
Yeah, I have no idea. I am just learning about her now, too.
Right.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
amazing.
It's one of those moments where, as you're talking, like, this woman's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
She should be dubbed, you know, something bigger than the Sun Queen. She should be one of the movements we see in, like, Women's History Month and that kind of thing.
Yes.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for presenting this with us. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's always nice to have you here. We love talking with you, and based on your numbers, our listeners do, too. So
yep,
thanks so much.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Until next time, I'm Phil Schaff.
I'm Phil Horinder.
And I'm Melissa Fisher. Another chapter has been added to the history textbooks.